Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince, they exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey, Dave.
Yeah, Randy.
Since we founded Bombas, we've always said our socks, underwear, and T-shirts are super soft. Any new ideas?
Maybe sublimely soft.
Or disgustingly cozy.
Wait, what?
I got it. Bombas. Absurdly comfortable essentials for yourself.
And for those facing homelessness.
Because one purchased equals one donated.
Wow, did we just write an ad?
Yes.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase.
Hi there, and welcome again to the Explaining History podcast. Now, if you've been listening to some of the military history stuff I've been doing recently, we've been focusing mainly on the British experience of the war at sea. And you can't really talk about that in any great depth without looking at the U-boat campaign against Great Britain during the Second World War, one which had been nearly as deadly to the British Isles during the First World War as well. Its resumption in 1917 leading to the introduction, the intervention of the USA into the war. In 1939, the war strategy that Hitler believed would be most effective against Great Britain wasn't the attempt to invade Britain in 1940, but was of course the war to starve Great Britain, using U-boats, sinking Britain's trade, Britain's convoys. Britain hadn't been a self-sufficient country for at least a century. Of course, the decision to switch to being a free trading country in the 1840s, which you know brought greatly reduced food to Britain and improved living standards, and of course Britain's empire, from which Britain Britain benefited from cheap foods, but mainly from the United States and its huge farming surpluses, meant that British living standards were conditional on imports, and this was Britain's Achilles heel. So we're looking at, as we normally do, at Max Hastings here, and the war at sea. And in it he writes, while Germany's capital ships commanded the headlines, and obviously means battleships like the Bismarck and the Tirpitz and the Scharnhorst and the Prince Eugen and things like that, and their sorties inflicted some injuries, Axis submarine and air forces represented a much graver long-term threat, and the men of both arms displayed courage and skill. U-boats achieved striking early successes, such as the sinking of the old battleship Royal Oak in Scapa Flow, which was the first major British naval disaster of the war, when German U-boats went underneath the submarine net at Scapa Flow and sank the Royal Oak, capsizing it. And wreaking havoc upon valuable merchantmen. Churchill, as First Lord of the Admiralty, estimated that the introduction of convoying in 1939 was responsible for a 30% fall in Britain's imports. Merchant ships were obliged to waste weeks waiting for convoys to assemble. Once ocean-bound, they travelled painfully slowly and were offloaded on arrival by lethargic and sometimes obstructive British dock labour force. Churchill, famously, as First Lord of the Admiralty in 1940, before his accession to Prime Minister after the Norway debates and the fall of Neville Chamberlain, squandered British warships in their fairly fruitless searches for U-boats as British merchantmen and other vessels began to be sunk. The technology wasn't there, and Churchill had little idea initially about what to do about the shipping losses. Churchill famously said, of course we've always got to be wary of this kind of Churchillian drift where all sorts of things can be attributed to him, but Churchill famously claimed that the Battle of the Atlantic was the only part of the war that really frightened him, and he could see the real prospect for Great Britain's defeat, which gives you an indication of how desperate the struggle was. Many ships that carried commodities in peacetime had to be diverted to move troops and munitions across huge distances by circuitous routes to avoid Axis air and submarine concentrations. For instance, almost all Egypt-bound cargoes travel via the Cape of Good Hope. The voyage to Suez lengthened from 3,000 miles to 13,000, while a Bombay-bound ship made a passage of 11,000 miles against a pre-war 6,000. Until 1943, the Royal Navy was desperately short of escorts and effective technology to hunt U-boats. The British tanked 12 German submarines in 1940, and just 3 in the 6 months between September that year and March 1941. intelligence and skillful convoy routing did more to frustrate Admiral Dönitz than did submarine escorts. Of course, we need to talk about the Enigma machine and the breaking of the Enigma codes and Alan Turing and all that sort of thing. But I think probably in the kind of 14 minutes we have left on this podcast, there's probably not enough time to give that, to do that justice. And I'm going to see if I can try to do something quite separate on that subject in the not-too-distant future. The Royal Navy was slow to realise the vulnerability of merchantmen off the African coast, where in 1941-42, two long-range Type 9 U-boats achieved some spectacular destruction, partly because they maintained wireless silence and partly because few defensive resources were available. The British were grievously hampered by lack of air support. The RAF's coastal command was short of planes. Its long-range Sunderland flying boats suffered from crews' poor navigational and depth-charge skills. Together with technical problems that reduced their effort in 1941 to an average of two sorties per month. Meanwhile, until 1942, many of the Royal Navy's destroyers remained committed to the coastal defence of Britain. In the course of the entire war, 6.1% of Allied shipping losses were inflicted by surface raiders and 6.5% by mines, 13.4% were caused by air attack and 70% were caused by U-boats. The British suffered their first severe blow in the autumn of 1940 when the slow-bound Atlantic convoy SC-7 lost 21 out of 30 ships and 12 out of 49 in the fast HX-79. Thereafter, the tempo of undersea war rose steadily. During 1941, 3.6 million tonnes of British shipping were lost, 2.1 million of those to submarines. Churchill became deeply alarmed. His post-war assertion that the U-boats caused him greater anxiety than any other threat to Britain's survival has powerfully influenced the historiography of the war. It's scarcely surprising that the Prime Minister was so troubled when almost every week until May 1943 he received loss statistics that represented a shockingly steady, debilitating depletion of Britain's transport capabilities. But the submarine force commanded by Dönitz was weak. Germany's pre-war industrial planning envisaged a fleet which achieved full war fighting capability only in 1944. Now, as you've heard me talk before, one of the key moments, and it's a hugely controversial and contested document, but one of the key moments in the history of Nazi Germany was the meeting that is recorded in the Hossbach Memorandum, where Hitler, the heads of the Air Force, Army and Navy, and some of the senior figures in the Nazi Party meet, and Hitler lays out his plan or his series of plans and possibilities for what war might look like in the next few years. Partly the reason for doing this was to discuss the kind of the economic bottleneck that Germany was in. As Germany rearms, inflation goes up, pumping money into the economy and there's scarce resources and the balance of payments is affected. And Hitler, not an economist himself, doesn't really know, other than conquering other countries, how you solve these problems. And the answer in the Hossbach Memorandum is we conquer other countries. But the other reason for gathering these service chiefs together was that there were arguments between them about which service was to get the most spending and therefore the most resources committed to it in order to grow. Hitler's kind of favourite service was obviously the Wehrmacht, the army. Second to that is the Air Force. Third, and a fairly distant third, is the Navy. Hitler's not really a Navy man. Hitler didn't build any aircraft carriers, for example. There are battleships, but to some extent these are prestige projects and not really at the forefront of Hitler's thinking. Hitler saw the value in U-boats, and during the war he certainly appreciates that they're very useful, and they're obviously a lot cheaper to build than battleships, but the infrastructure isn't there to make them on the scale that Raeder first and then Dönitz wanted. Dönitz believed that if he was given 500 boats he could win the war. Part of the problem here as well is that when Fritz Todt, the Minister for Armaments, died in a mysterious plane crash, and Speer took over, Speer inherited chaos. He found factories that were empty, or that they were producing too many of the wrong sorts of things, and the entire German munitions system, munitions industry, is working in a state of chaos, and to some extent that goes for the production of huge capital equipment like U-boats. Naval construction was skewed by a focus on big ships. 100 U-boats could still have been built with the steel lavished on the Bismarck. On the eve of the war, Admiral Erich Raeder, German naval commander-in-chief, wrote, "We are not in a position to play anything like an important part in the war against Britain's commerce." Until June 1940, Dönitz did not anticipate waging a major campaign in the Atlantic. Because he was denied the means to do so, the small, short-range Type 7 boats that dominated his armoury were designed to operate from German bases. Even when the strategic picture radically changed with Hitler's seizure of Norway and of the French Atlantic ports, the Kriegsmarine continued to build Type 7s. Productivity in German shipyards, hampered by shortages of steel and skilled labour, and later by bombing, fell below British levels. U-boats remained technically primitive. Innovation, for instance, in the 1944-45 Schnorkel underwater air replenishment system was not matched by reliability. The revolutionary Type 21 sailed in its first war patrol only on the 30th of April 1945, so that's, you know, less than 2 weeks before the end of the war. Thus, Dönitz forced lacked mass, range and quality. Just as the Luftwaffe in 1940-41 attempted to deal a knockout blow to Britain with wholly inadequate resources, so the U-boat arm lacked strength to accomplish the severance of the Atlantic link. And there's something kind of deeply inimical, deeply, well, there's a deep connection really here to the workings of Nazism and the kind of the basis of Nazi thinking here. In that Hitler, whilst he ideally wanted a well-equipped navy and air force, managed to kind of bluster his way through questions of lack of resources by saying that really it was the will of the German airman and sailor and soldier that was being tested, and that will would triumph, and the will of the German people would triumph. And there was a kind of a sense of this in everything that happened within Nazism. Like, you know, Ian Kershaw's argument that Nazism looked kind of orderly and meticulously planned on the outside, but inside it was really quite a chaotic system. That presents itself as a kind of a truth when you look at the shortcomings of German military production, and in many theatres of war, German soldiers, airmen and sailors going to war without the things that they actually need. Dönitz calculated that he needed to sink 600,000 tons of British shipping a month, and to achieve a decisive victory, for which he required 300, I correct myself, I said 500 before, but it's actually 300 U-boats in commission to sustain a third of that number in operational areas. Yet only 13 U-boats were on station in August 1940, falling to 8 in January 1941, rising to 21 the following month. This small force inflicted impressive destruction. 2 million tons of British shipping were sunk between June 1940 and March 1941. but in the same period, just 72 new U-boats were delivered, far short of the number Dönitz needed. They achieved the highest rate of productivity, measured by tonnage sunk per submarine at sea, in October 1940. Thereafter, while many more boats were deployed, their pro rata achievements diminished. As the war developed, the Allied navies grew apace in skill and professionalism, and the quality and determination of U-boat crews declined. One by one, Dönitz's aces were killed or captured, and the men who replaced them were of lesser calibre. Submarine crews had short life expectancies at sea. In 1940, the submarine crew captains were almost celebrities in Germany. They were considered to be heroes and feted by Hitler, who had a sudden new appreciation for the U-boat. But they had their war was going to be a kind of an uphill struggle when they had to face the combined intelligence and technology capacity of the United States Navy and the British Royal Navy, that learned quicker and quicker how to use ASDIC and other sonar based systems and aircraft spotting and depth charges in order to quickly find and eliminate U-boats. German naval intelligence and grasp of Allied strategy, tactics and technology was chronically weak. Again, British signals intelligence, Bletchley Park, that broke Enigma, the Enigma codes, was streaks ahead of Germany, and the ability of the British also to mask their own intelligence coups and to prevent the Germans from working out what the fact that the Enigma codes had been broken was of fundamental importance. So we'll talk some more about this in the coming weeks or so, and I've got some really awesome new stuff to bring you. Particularly, I'm really excited to be bringing you Mike Davis's Set the Night on Fire, which is a radical history of Los Angeles in the 1960s. Anyway, we're gonna pause there. Thanks very much for listening, everybody, and I hope you find this useful. You check us out on explaininghistory.org, and there's always the Patreon there for anyone that'd like to donate to keep the podcast going. Thanks very much, everybody. All the best. Bye-bye. One that's mirrored in the huge problems in the US healthcare sector and the difficulty that the seemingly intractable problem of attempts to create a free at the point of use healthcare service, which most of the modern countries in some way, shape or form enjoy. The implications for the rest of the world, as I said, are stark. The organisations and wealthy backers who have managed to overturn Roe versus Wade will now be immensely emboldened. Perhaps they won't succeed in Europe, but they will try. You know, of that you must be absolutely certain. And wherever you are, if you're not in the US, watch the media that you consume and look for the messages that will no doubt be kind of dropped into newspaper columns and leaders and here and in op-eds in on TV shows and radio and podcasts, because there will be an attempt to make the argument first for the curbing and reduction of abortion rights, and then perhaps an outright ban similar to Roe versus Wade. These things often tend to follow. And also, this might be a huge and important moment for the women's movement inside America and beyond. It's difficult to say at the moment. There doesn't seem to have been the kind of spontaneous mass organizing that happened when Trump was first elected in 2016. But give it time. Give it time. It's only been a day or two, and no doubt there is a flurry of activity amongst the women's movements in America to organise some form of resistance. Okay, well, listen, I'm going to leave the update there. We're going to be coming back to that hopefully later in the week. Apologies, I've done fewer updates this week because, again, I've been suffering from long COVID and it's been kind of tiring. But, you know, I'll get over that. Thanks very much, everybody. I hope you find this useful, and we'll be getting back to some regular history in a moment. All the best. Thanks. Bye-bye.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.